Good afternoon, everybody. It's nice to see you all. I feel like I know most of you now after the last day and a half, but For those of you who I haven't introduced myself to, I'm Lisa McAhern. I work for NICFA, but I also had the great luck and fortune to be one of the Northern Ireland Development Fund cohorts. I was funded as part of the exchange in round two. And my project is what we're going to talk about a bit today. It was the Northern Ireland Development Fund who facilitated us to be able to host this event about punk economics today. My project was really a dream project that I had for a long time around how we challenge the traditional discourse on economics, how we make this thing that had been the preserve of professors and bankers and businessmen, but impacted in all our lives. So how do we make this thing real to citizens in Northern Ireland? Our interest in NICFA is the community and voluntary sector and our members, but actually it's about way more than that. It's about everyone who lives here. And for a long time, we've been kind of trying to edge our way onto the table when it came to economic conversations. And the real pin drop moment was when I was at the Northern Ireland Economic Conference one year, and I paid a lot of money to go, and I was in the Clawdon, and the car park was full of BMWs, and every speaker, 16 speakers, all male, all said the same thing. There was no challenge, there was no women, there was no fun, and there was no sense of what actually it means for the things they were talking about. There couldn't have been, I don't think I've ever been at a conference where there was more distance between what people were saying and the reality that I knew the people in our sector were experiencing with the people and the families and the communities they work with. And it was kind of then I thought, no way, we have to do something about this. The opportunity for the funding came along, I came up with the idea to create an economic think tank, but that would also have a research function. I wanted to poke around in the parts of the economy and economic ideas that don't really make the mainstream because they're not politically popular. And we've got a number of reports. Our most recent one is the case for a land value tax for Northern Ireland, which is a progressive taxation system that helps avoid housing bubbles and that the Northern Ireland Executive can actually do. But it's never really got any political traction. We've commissioned a report to show that it is possible that it could happen. So that's the kind of thing I wanted the Centre for Economic Empowerment to do. And I'm so delighted that the idea that I had about bringing economics to citizens has come to fruition, really, and it's going from strength to strength. But actually, David McWilliams was way ahead of me, and way ahead of most of us on that. And, you know, it was reading his work, following his social media, reading punk economics and watching the videos that made me also believe, actually, you can do this. It's not a distant, ivory-tower discipline. And if you ground economics in reality, I'm interested to see what change, what progressive change can we get out of that. So today is brilliant because it brings together all of those ideas. It's made possible by the funding, and David McWilliams is here. So for me, this is another part of that. Yesterday we talked about finding your own personal Everest and trying to climb it. This is me getting even closer to the summit now, and that's very exciting. I'm really delighted that our host is John Campbell. John is the business and economics editor for the BBC, but he also understands economics. It's been a long time since I heard BBC coverage of things like the economics of poverty, of a living wage, of the implications of childcare, and John covers those in a way that matters and in a way that explains them. I can now understand the Good Morning Ulster economics broadcast, and that's pretty impressive. So I'm going to hand over to John. We're going to be here with each other for the next kind of couple of hours. I would say in all of this kind of sense of community we're trying to build up with the summer school, this is very much a conversation. It's absolutely not a lecture. And this is the part I'm really looking forward to. I'm going to join you all now and not be behind the camera for a change. John.
Thank you very much. It's my great pleasure to welcome David McWilliams to the Exchange Summer School. For an event which is all about changing the conversation, David is an important man to have with us. He has very broad experience of trying to change the conversation when it comes to how we think and talk about economics, and that's not always made him popular. I think of a couple of lines of his which I have returned to time and again when reporting on the late Anglo-Irish Bank. He wrote that Anglo was simply a leveraged hedge fund betting its own and its clients' money on overvalued property, adding, "Normally when the property market collapses, these type of outfits go bust. That would have been a very easy thing to write in 2008 and 2009. Now, David actually wrote that, I think it was either late 2006 or early 2007, so about a full year before Anglo was awarded the title Best Bank in the World, and a further 2 years before David's prediction was sadly realised, with consequences that we still live with today. And that was just part of a much bigger effort to change the conversation about the Irish economic miracle. It was about trying to move away from cheerleading to questioning and analysis. And in the way which David has done that is an example to anyone who writes about economics, as Lisa was suggesting. If you want to have a conversation, you need to make yourself understood. And that involves taking sometimes obscure concepts and relating them back to people's lives. For example, in a recent column, David moves very smartly between David Moyes and Tomas Piketty to explain the winner-takes-all tendencies of our system. And what's been most impressive, I think, is David's ability to take economics way beyond the book or the column into stand-up and then a fully-fledged festival of economics, and increasingly by harnessing the power of the internet as a teaching medium, particularly through his punk economics animations, which, as it happens, is the title of our event today. David is also quite special as an economist from the Republic, in that he has some knowledge of, and even a little bit of interest in Northern Ireland, although I think for personal reasons he's absolutely required to have that. So I give you David McWilliams.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here in Fermanagh. It's not a place I know, but my father-in-law was in school here in Portora, so I've always been aware that there's some connection with this neck of the woods. And it's funny, you know, John was talking about, for personal reasons, my wife is from Belfast, and I wasn't really aware that she would be so dogmatic about where our children were born until I found myself in the East Belfast Hospital in Dundonald as the only expectant father not wearing a Rangers tracksuit, which was deeply distressing to me. Also, deeply distressing was my wife's advice to me not to speak while we were in the waiting room, which was, again, quite a shock. And this is all kind of happens when you meet somebody in London. You know, when you're Irish in London, you forget all this malarkey. And it really came home to me. What happens is you meet this sort of pretty cool clubbing chick from the north, and then she turns into a Protestant mother. Nobody explained that little bit to us, and it was brought home to me so materially when Sian declared that our children would be born in the north, which I thought was just simply, you know, a rush of blood to the head and this wouldn't happen, but our daughter Lucy was born in 2000 in the north, and I again thought that as Sian was going through the pregnancy that my flirtation with the boys with the Rangers tracksuits was really again something to kind of unnerve me and prepare me for fatherhood more than to actually be the roadmap to the delivery. And the night our daughter was born, we were in Dublin, in South Dublin, so to go around Dublin. And Sian woke up and said, "I think the child is coming." And I said, "Oh, well, really? Are you sure?" And she said, "Well, I don't usually wet the bed." So this was the beginning of a process, which I actually wrote in the book. I wrote called The Pope's Children under the auspices of different characters, but this is a true story. And we got into a Fiat Punto and drove with broken waters from Dublin all the way to Belfast, pre the motorway. So now Dublin-Belfast is a straight road, it's a motorway, etc., it's all grand. But then you have to go through little places like Balbriggan, Drogheda, and Dundalk. And I remember at this stage that we were all beginning to panic. It was the three of us at this stage that we included the child in the ongoing trauma of getting to the north. And I had forgotten the extent to which Northerners from, let's say, from Dundonald, who, as you know, are a special tribe themselves, their view of the South was one of tolerance and forbearance more than anything particularly friendly. And this came back to me very, very hauntingly and quite shockingly as we hoored through Drogheda and we were outside Dundalk, and I saw a sign for the hospital in Dundalk, and it was the hospital which I believe is just between Newry and Dundalk. And Sian looked at me, she says, "If this child is born in Dundalk, I'll brain you." So, that was my first real introduction to having what I call my mongrel children, who are half Dorky and half Dundonald. And so I come here quite a bit. And I've had long discussions with my late father-in-law, whose name is appropriately Billy, about economics and things. When usually, you like this, John, the end of debates on economics, usually fueled by ridiculous amounts of Tesco's Finest Red, he would slam the table and accuse me of talking like a Jesuit, which I didn't realise is an insult, but apparently it's a shocking thing to do. So I do know the North very well, and I've come here all the time. I come here about once a month, and but it's usually to the very southern friendly climate that is Dundonald and Cumber, yes, which is where they're from. But today I'd like to talk to you a wee bit about economics. It's always intrigued me how economists get things wrong, and they go from absolute inaccuracy to complete falsehood without any period of humility in the middle, which is kind of shocking. And I speak as somebody who worked in the Irish Central Bank on the policy side, then I worked for investment banks, and then I came back to Ireland and started writing books and doing TV programs and all that sort of stuff, which I now describe as, people ask me what it is, it's kind of better than a real job. I'm not too sure what I do anymore. But what is intriguing is the extent to which economists, and this goes to what Lisa was talking about outside the Culloden Hotel, a place I know quite well, and how economists get things wrong and don't realise why. So, for example, the vast majority didn't see this bust coming. And the reason is they don't really understand human nature. And economics is nothing more than the... study is too swanky a word for it. So then the observation of human nature. So what I think we'll do now, I'm just going to show you one of these punk economics videos. I made them with a friend of mine who was an old mate, very old friend of mine, who was a fantastic cartoonist in school and went on to work for Disney as the chief animator in Tangled. But he's always a bit of a head. And his idea of corporate life, I thought Disney was going to be fine for him. It's a real corporate... It's a bit like working for someone like Microsoft. So he left, but I remember a couple of years ago I bumped into him, and his only two loves in the world are American basketball, which I know nothing about, and extreme heavy metal. Okay? And I was chatting about economics, and he said to me, he said, "Listen, Mackerman," he says, "I've never read your books. I don't like listening to you on the telly, actually, the truth, you know. I hear you in the radio, it kind of gets on me nerves." He says, "But we're going to make this look like something people can understand." And I think that's the way to do it. So if you have a quick look at this, these are Trinity students of mine in front. If we just put this on, I think it should work. I'll move out of the way. And then you'll see what I'm trying to get at. Days, I have received all sorts of economic forecasts from some of the very economists who didn't see this crisis coming in the first place. Of all the characters we should fear in 2013, the overconfident economic forecaster will surely be one of them. The Queen of England was first to spill the beans,
when she asked, why didn't you guys predict the crash?
Oh, well, yeah. Oh, my God.
And if you didn't see this calamity coming, why should I bother listening to you now? And maybe the reason we economists can't predict the future is we don't really understand the present. Traditional economics starts with the basic notion that people are rational and see the world in a rational, cold, logical way, the way economists do. But this, of course, is complete and utter nonsense. In reality, humans are completely irrational. We are driven by emotions, by exuberances, impulses, and frenzies. We fall in love. We gamble. We even support useless football teams. But these irrational, illogical, and beautifully human urges dominate our decision-making. Like, we generally don't learn from our mistakes. We always think, next time it's going to be different. And when we're faced with enormous statistical evidence, we tend to ignore it. The National Lottery, with its "it could be you" slogan, trades on this. But you know, the interesting thing is, it's not the average Joe on the street that makes these mistakes. It seems that professional gamblers, people who look at the form all the time, they also are driven by wild emotions. Now, to get a handle on just how extreme this behaviour is, I decided to go to the fastest growing bookies in Ireland, Paddy Power's, a place where young mathematicians are constantly looking at data from horse racing meetings and from football scores, trying to assess risk and price risk. And you know what? The good people at Paddy Power's proved to me that we are incredibly irrational. Not rational, but irrational.
Make your bets now, ladies and gentlemen.
The hard data from the bookies tell us that even when the chances of two horses winning are the same, Irish punters will bet 21% more on the Irish horse than the English horse. And in online gambling, we will bet 24% more on an Irish horse than a foreign horse, even though the chances of both horses winning are exactly the same. So think about it. If the professionals are driven by irrationality and emotion, what chance is there for the rest of us? But this lack of logic explains why the economy works as it does. When things are going brilliantly, we all get far too exuberant and we feel that the party will never stop. And then, when things are going badly, we all become far too pessimistic and we feel that the crisis will never end. And in the real world, it's those people who go against the herd that actually make money. In recent years, investors who made money were those who were actually selling when everybody else was buying, and those who were buying when everybody else was selling. But these lads and lassies, they are the exception. The norm is the rest of us. So at the end of the day, the economists have got it all wrong. The vast majority of us are totally irrational, and it's only a small minority who are actually rational. Now, this dilemma at the heart of modern economics was best summed up by J.P. Morgan, the legendary American banker, when he said of booms and busts that nothing so undermines your financial judgment as the sight of your neighbour getting rich. Now, all this implies that much of the economics that we teach in university has got absolutely nothing to do with real human behaviour. So this is the big challenge for economics, because if we don't actually understand what makes the average person tick, then how in God's name can we forecast how he's going to behave? So the next time you hear an economist on the radio or the television telling you exactly what's going to happen next year, you should be warned that this person believes that everybody is rational, when we know that we humans are beautifully and gloriously irrational.
That's just a way of looking at the world, which I was always intrigued by this. You know, I did economics. I did a master's in economics, and I've been teaching economics for years. And economists get up and they start talking about this human being that is rational. I've never met anyone who's rational. And if I did, I wouldn't go for a drink with them. No, seriously, the sort of person that economists talk about as being representative of us human beings doesn't exist. And as a consequence of that, if you don't take into account emotions, herd behavior, love, all the crazy things we do, you will underestimate the extent to which humans make mistakes, and you will overestimate the extent to which we can see into the future, and ultimately then you will make huge mistakes in forecasting what the world's about. This, in my opinion, is because economics is driven by very, very poor mathematicians who weren't clever enough to be mathematicians, and then they got foisted on us economists, and they've turned economics into something very, very sterile, which is increasingly irrelevant. And it's driven by, and I know because I'm somebody who's studied this stuff, it's driven by the urge to have an elegant mathematical model which adds up, rather than the bizarre, opaque, and I think much more interesting world of human behavior, where clearly, yes, people do respond to incentives, but we do so in a very odd way. So that is my way of starting when I'm talking to students first, to explain to them how I believe we should look at the world. And then, you know, you take a wee bit of history and a little bit of psychology and a little bit of mathematics and a little bit of statistics to measure stuff, and you throw it all into the mix, and that's what I think economics is. It's a very broad church.
Just on that point, David, some of you may be aware that there is, within the academic economics profession, a huge row going on at the moment about how the subject is actually taught. Like, very recently we had a Harvard Economics 101 class, lots of them walking out en masse because they didn't like the classical economics they were being taught. So I suppose there's a question around what students should be taught. Is it still right that people get the groundings and the basics of Adam Smith and so forth, that they learn about mathematics, they know how to use Excel? Is it a case that they still need to learn that, but they also need to learn about the bubbles, the panics, and the irrationality of economics?
Can I tell you, so I've never actually used Excel. In 20 years, I swear to God, I wouldn't know what to do with it. I've never used it. I've never... Other people have used it who work with me, but I've actually never used it. I couldn't tell you what to do with it. Adam Smith, now there's a peculiar little fella. No, really, I mean, he was a peculiar little fella. I mean, what I like about Adam Smith was that he was a radical at a time of monarchies. And I think you should see Adam Smith in the context of a Scottish intellectual movement in the late 18th century, which was an extraordinary thing to say at a time when people actually believed almost, maybe not in this part of the world, but certainly in France and other places, in the divine right of kings. And he was saying, well, this is actual fact, you don't need a god or kings, just leave people alone and they'll do their own thing. The interesting thing about Adam Smith, he was almost entirely forgotten about until the 1980s, when he was resurrected for ideological reasons by Mrs. Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, to really suit an agenda which was very, very clear to me, was driven to make rich people richer and poor people pretty much poorer. And it succeeded in a pretty dramatic way. And, you know, all movements need ideological niceties to uphold them. And all the better if you pluck from obscurity some bizarre little dissembling Scottish weirdo, which he was, actually, at the time. What I like about Adam Smith is the fact that his great book, The Wealth of Nations, was published in three places. Now, Adam Smith, remember, was the founder of free market economics. You should leave the market alone. You should never interfere with the market, and the market is always right. And whatever conclusion the market comes to or opportunities it throws up, they themselves are fantastic expressions of liberalism, free thinking, and freedom of choice. And you should never, ever, ever interfere with whatever the market throws up. Now, the very interesting thing is the Wealth of Nations, the book that made him most famous, was published in three places: Edinburgh, London, and bootlegged in Dublin. This is a true story. The largest sales at the time of the Wealth of Nations were not official. they were bootlegged copyright products made in Dublin. Now, at the time, the Dublin Printers Guild were like the sort of Pearl Delta rip-off football jersey merchants of the 17th century and 18th century. And what happened was Dubliners used to send over people to the States to see what was selling. So the big book market for the English language was the United States colonies. And they'd send over people, they'd get it back, said, geez, this book by this little Scottish fellow is selling very well. And they would obviously infringe copyright, print hundreds of them unofficially in Dublin, and ship them out to the States. So the vast majority of the royalties of poor little Adam Smith's book actually accrued to gangsters in Dublin. And Adam Smith took terrible umbrage with this, and he took them to court in London, the Dublin Printers Guild, to which they responded, well, isn't this not the invisible hand? So he's like all right-wingers. It's free market, but it's going your way. And then when it's not going your way, you get the law to bash the gullet. So there you go.
Just on that general point, that Smith also wrote a lot about whenever lots of merchants come together, they're inevitably stitching things up in their favour.
Yeah.
They tend towards the creation of cartels. As somebody who believes in capitalism and wants it to work,
yeah,
isn't it the case of what has become increasingly apparent over the last number of years is for capitalism to really work, what it needs is very, very robust regulation. And regulation to a much greater extent is taken seriously in the States. But in Ireland, this myth grew up that capitalism can only flourish if all regulations are stripped away.
Yeah, no. So it's not just merchants that get together. When charities get together, they do the same thing. You know, it's when everybody with a vested interest gets together, they extract rent out of other lads. That's the gig. You know, and I've no problem with that as long as you can see it. I think what happened in Ireland was a sort of a... It was a very strange hybrid of... Because I remember when I came out very early on, and I'd been lucky enough in my career to work in emerging markets. So that was Argentina, Israel, Russia, all these places. I worked for a Swiss bank. And I'd seen these sort of bubbles emerge, and it was so obvious to me when I came home, and I made the, I don't know if it was a fatal mistake or an inspired move of going on the Late Late, which... It was actually my mother and my family never had a VCR all through the 80s and 90s until my inaugural appearance in the Late Late in 2000. Just when VCRs were actually banished and disappearing, my ma went out and bought one and taped it and obviously sent it to all her sisters in Cork, because Cork people are like all snobs, you know that. And during the boom, I kept saying that, kept coming out and saying that this was going to lead to a disaster for us. And Bertie Ahern, in his own strange way, had decided to go and muse aloud as to why people like me didn't go and commit suicide, which was a very unusual, maybe Drumcondra way of expressing yourself. But my mother at the time, just to fill the story, which I hadn't intended to do, but anyway, she rang me, and she said, Bertie Ahern is after mentioning you inside the Dawn. And I said, yes, Mum, but it wasn't that complimentary. She said, I don't care. He didn't mention Mrs. McCarthy's son. So there's a silver lining in every cloud. And that's the Cork way of looking at the world, which I subscribe to. But I what you had was this... I worked in the central bank. It's my first job. Central Bank in Ireland was a sick, sick organisation. And by that I mean, I went in there with some swanky title at the age of 24, and I knew very, very quickly that I had to get out, because it was the civil servant's civil servant, okay? So there was absolutely no objective to the place, and therefore it was entirely politics. So anybody who got to the top really knifed their way up, right? There was no talent. And then these were the guys who were supposed to be presiding over the banking system. But they were probably more interested in playing golf with the bankers than actually chiding them. That's the first thing. The second thing, which you see in all small countries, whether it's the Asian crisis or Latin America, is this bizarre fusion of economic success and patriotism. That, you know, in actual fact, I'd gone to Iceland. Iceland was really kind of outrageously delinquent. Even made us look like Presbyterians, actually. And it's but they drew up a narrative to suggest that because back in Icelandic history, in the Vikings, that the Vikings like Eric the Red and all those sort of dudes had actually gone out from Iceland and from and found Greenland and found there was intrinsically a genetic Icelandic piece of a chromosome which propelled them to trade in obscure places. And this was the reason why Icelandic companies were buying everything from West Ham Football Club to Burberry, okay? That this was an Icelandic gene. And so I think that's, you know, countries need to create a narrative, and that's what they did. It was all bullshit, of course, right? It was just, they were borrowing lots of money, and they were investing in anything that moved, and then the whole thing collapsed. And in Ireland, I think we just created the same sort of narrative. I used to love this great that that we were better builders than other people, right? And which may or may not be true, but it's just nonsense. Or that we, because of emigration, we were obviously much more brilliant at appraising risk in Bulgaria because Irish people had lived in Boston. I couldn't figure that out myself. But so I mean, I think what you have is, you have patriotism, you also have a sense of a country that has really been kicked around. Okay, I don't want to get all maudlin and, you know, Shanos on you, but you have, and then you've 70 years of the madness of the Republic of Ireland, the first chapter, okay, and all the economic underachievement, and so many people emigrated, and the country I was born in the 60s was so backward, and it really was backward. And then suddenly you think, Jesus, we're rich. And that gives you a certain sort of madness. And this is back to the idea of human nature. You know, it's like, I think people behave in economics like they do when they fancy people when they're teenagers. You know, when you fancy somebody when you're teenagers, right? You'll come up with any old yarn to convince yourself that she fancies you. Okay, this is the first thing. And you'll do unnatural acts in order to keep her by your side. And you'll display her like a trophy, or him, whatever, because I presume, because we're in the sort of right on sector, him or her or whatever, right? Right, all that good stuff. And I think that, you know, I know it's not the answer you're expecting, but the thing with regulation, right? We will do this again. We will have, in this country, in Britain you're having one, in England anyway, at the moment, you're having the same sort of carry on the London housing market. Humans don't learn. We will have this again. No matter what the best will in the world, the best regulation will maybe at the margin affect human behaviour. But this stuff, this idea of booms and busts, John, you know, I'll appeal to your Ballymena side here. It's as old as the Bible. You know, in actual fact, one could argue that Joseph in Genesis was the first finance minister ever. Because the Pharaoh said to him, Jesus, man, we got all these eaves and corn shit, man. And he said, if I were you now, I'd put them away for 7 years because there'll be a boom. And then 7 years later, there'll be a bust. And you'll need all the corn. Remember all that sort of stuff from the Bible? It's all there. That's human nature. So I'm not too sure. I mean, regulation, yeah, it sounds good. But it doesn't change human nature.
Which it kind of reminds me of the last Nobel Prize. It was a bit of a weird situation.
It was, actually.
Because you had Robert Schiller, the man who is the main theorist of bubbles. He says that bubbles happen, and they will always happen. But he had to share the prize with the man who says, no, they don't happen. There's a thing called the efficient market hypothesis, which says that markets always correct themselves, that markets never get out of whack, really. And to some extent, maybe one of the big problems in economics, as it's been taught and it's been understood, is this thought that markets just behave rationally, as you say, and this one theory has kind of taken root within economics departments, and it's very hard to get out of that mindset.
Well, it's a really very silly theory, and it also leads to something called shareholder value, which is what drives large corporations to reduce their sense of social responsibility. I mean, if you contrast, for example, corporations now to some of the great corporations, let's say Cadbury's, Roundtree's, Guinness's in Dublin, in over the years, you know, who realised that they were part of a very sensitive ecosystem, and that ecosystem involved building the Ivy Gardens, the Ivy Baths, for, you know, looking after workers, etc. This is obviously pre-welfare state stuff, but it was a
there was a holistic sense of what business is, driven, I think, not necessarily by great altruism, but arguably a sense of we've got to keep everybody sweet to keep it going. Then, as a result of the efficient markets hypothesis, we get this idea of shareholder values, that all companies have to do is maximise shareholders, which basically means, you know, the owners of the company and nobody else is involved in the company. But that's really nonsense, because anybody who's, like, for example, I run a small company with 8 people, so I technically own it. But if the other 8 people weren't working today, the company would collapse. And, you know, it would collapse. We wouldn't produce anything, because I'm up here mouthing off about behavioural economics and things. So it seems to me that, back to the Nobel Prize idea, the Nobel Prize in economics would be a fab thing to win, because you could charge 150 grand for speech, which is obviously a very good thing for those people who win it. But I think it's a reflection of the sort of schizophrenia you touched on, this, or not so much schizophrenia, but this inability to know what economics is about, that two people from polar opposites of the spectrum were given an award and nobody sniggered in the back.
I suppose just to move to one of the other great debates of recent times, which is closely related to that, is something which is affecting us all, is going to affect the voluntary sector, I think, a lot more in the coming few years, which is...
Don't refer to the BBC like that.
Which is, yeah, the BBC as well. It's the debate around austerity and whether it works. Because really what has happened, as we discussed this morning here in Good Morning Ulster, was there are two models of what governments do in a crisis. When households stop spending and businesses stop spending, traditionally, on the Keynesian model, what governments do is say, we need to step in, we need to keep demand in the economy, we need to spend more, we need a stimulus. And that's what Barack Obama has done to a certain extent. The flip side of that, as you say, the problem is we're spending too much, debt is a problem, people, the international investors, lose confidence as they say our debts rocket, so we need to rein back spending, we need to stop spending immediately, and then once confidence returns, business will fill the gap and the whole thing will kick off again. So the question for me really is, many people have said austerity, the second model, won't work. It will kill economies. We're now in a position where we see the UK economy has returned to growth, the Republic to a certain extent has returned to growth, and both those are economies which were forced to a large extent to embrace austerity, and you could also include Spain in that. So is there any way by which you would say, well, maybe the critics of austerity got it wrong?
Well, I think it's what's very interesting is the way in which we in the media, both of us, look at the growth rate at a moment in time and use that to project forward and to a degree validate backward. What I think is the most egregious thing about recessions is what it does to people's lives, how it affects them. Probably the one reason overall that I got into economics, and this is answering your question in sort of a roundabout way, is my dad lost his job when I was 10, at the same age as my son, a little bit younger than my son is now. And it wasn't supposed to happen in Monkstown, which is a reasonably middle-class area of just outside Dunleary, of South Dublin. My dad put on a suit every day for a year, pretended to go to work when I was in primary school. And he pretended to go to work because he was so ashamed of being out of work at a time when none of the dads on our road were out of work. And I asked him in later life what he did, because it really stuck with me. And he said he used to go to British Bay, which is a big beach down in Wicklow, by the Dublin Mountains, and walk around there on his own because of the shame he felt of possibly meeting somebody that he knew. And I remember again as a kid, you know, your mum and dad, like I do with my own children, you know, would put you to bed and then they'd start to have the conversations they wanted to have for the 4 hours when you were buzzing around watching Star Trek and acting the maggot, saying, come on, play football with me and all that sort of stuff. And I used to remember the conversations as a child that were
there was a difference in my parents' tone between the worried conversations they had together and the upbeat conversations they had with me and my sisters. And I think my father was very, very traumatised by this. But as an Irish man born in the 1930s, the ability to express his emotions was, I think, he just didn't have the language to do so. He didn't feel he had the permission to do so. And I, that stuck with me, particularly as I kind of went to quite a posh school because my parents put money together. You know, all those sort of things that happens to you as you're young. And then during the height of the recession, I've got one of my cousins is a local doctor. He's also from Cork. And he is known in the family as Eamon the Doctor because having a doctor is so unbelievably impressive. He's also from a little place called Ballyvourney, which is a Gaeltacht, which is, if you know it, it's in very West Cork, very, very bizarre part of West Cork. My mother describes them as incomprehensible in two languages, stand there. And actually, now that I'm thinking of it, the village is so bizarre that my cousins are triplets, but they are triplets from the 1960s, when this is pre-IVF, and nobody had triplets, and they're still referred to in Ballyvourney as the Tree Twins. It's kind of odd. One of the Tree Twins is a doctor outside Galway. And Galway, you know, is a city that was, when I was a kid, it was very small, but it's got very, very big over the last few years. And it has lots of commuter towns. And he's the local GP in one of the commuter towns. And he rang me in 2009, 2010, and we were chatting away. And he said, you know, if you really want to understand what's going on in the economy, David, he said, come to my clinic. I said, why is that, Eamon? He said, well, because I'm the local GP. I'm the first line that these people, I'm the first person these people go to. I said, what people? He said, the people have lost their jobs and are in negative equity. And I said, what do you do? He says, I'm giving them Smarties. I said, how do you mean? He said, we're just giving them antidepressants. He said, but I have no competence in this. I'm a doctor. I'm a GP. I fix broken wrists. Tell people they have kidney infections, right? He said, people are presenting, he said, in their dozens, right, because of depression. And if you actually look, Ireland has spent four times more on antidepressants in 2011 than it did in 2007. So, to answer your question, I'm more interested in the costs of economic failure than the number. And austerity, to me, exacerbated the chances of many good people ending up like my dad. Okay? Of that shame, that trauma. And therefore it's unforgivable for a state to involve themselves in that carry-on. And you say, well, what would have been the alternative to it? When you have too much debt, which was the problem in Ireland, due to this rush of blood to the head, and it wasn't greed. You know, the narrative in Ireland is that most people, and you see it in Britain too, people get into negative equity because they were greedy. That's actually not the point. Most people I know who are negative equity actually get into negative equity for love. Actually, they met somebody at a certain stage of their life, they had kids, and they bought a house. And at the time, so they all, if you think about it, all the people in negative equity did it from the age of 26 to 36. And what is the common denominator in that period of your life is you fall madly in love and you have kids. So the vast majority of people in Ireland who are in negative equity did so because, not because they were irresponsible, John, but because they were actually being responsible. Everyone said, buy this house, get a roof over your head, you're the boss now, you've got the kids, you've got the missus is saying to you, get yourself sorted out. So the narrative that has sprung up over the years is that these people were greedy. They're not. And if you take a society like this, which is too much debt, the way you solve it, and it's got what's called a balance sheet recession, this is what's wrong in Ireland, is you solve it with less debt, not more debt. And even in Egypt knows that. If your balance sheet has got too much debt, the way out of it is less debt, not more debt. Now, the Brits have one way of doing it, which is inflating away, right? Which is going back to the same carry-on, which is exactly what you're doing with your man Carney. He looks well, but just beware. He was educated by Jesuits. In the St. Francis Xavier School in Edmonton, Catholic school. I wrote that this morning because he came up with, anyway, great ruse last night, how the Bank of England is going to solve the housing problem in England, which is taken out of St. Augustine's portfolio of make me virtuous, but just not yet, O Lord. And I can see the Jesuit in Carney
freaking out the old boys in Threadneedle Street, but they don't figure that out yet. But you need less debt. So the way the Brits are going to do it, you're going to have another housing boom, and you'll end up in the same place in about 2 or 3 years' time, maybe 4 or 5, right? But it'll look good for a while. And that's cool, because looking good is better than looking bad, okay? You know? The other way you could do it is by actually negotiating away the debt, which is not that unusual, actually, by actually having debt forgiveness. And debt forgiveness, for me, seems to be what we could still do in Ireland and should have done, which would have minimised the costs of it. I don't know if you remember when Iceland defaulted and devalued and de-everything. And all the Irish politicians said, oh, Jesus, who wouldn't want to be Iceland? Oh, Jesus. It's a basket case. We weren't even allowed to go to Donegal in case Icelandic stuff came in off and infected us, you know, the Icelandic ideas. And I remember going to Iceland to have a look at what a basket case was like, because I'm interested in that sort of stuff. And I did that great economic research for which I'm famed, talking to fellas in bars and taxi drivers and, you know, Egypt on the street. And it struck me, about 6 months after the Icelandics had defaulted and devalued and trying to get lost, that the only people who were actually worried in Iceland were English bankers looking for their money back. And I put this to the Icelandic finance minister, and he looked at me with these big, remember, these big, big glasses, and Reykjavik's a very strange city. You look out over it, and then there's this huge kind of mountain, and then there's just this massive North Atlantic, like fish, sort of the sort of stuff you see in the North Atlantic coast when it's really wild. But this is all the time, and you have a real sense you're totally surrounded by it. And he took his glasses kind of halfway down, and he said, but we have no money. He's surely gone. We can give them fish if they like. Now, the interesting thing was, he wasn't taking the mickey. He was saying, it's all gone. And the Icelandics defaulted on everything. And the financial markets said, oh, Jesus, we won't go back to those fellas. And what happened? Nobody cared. About 6 months later, the very people who were defaulted on came back and started lending again. Because that's the way the world works. So I believe, to answer your question, is that austerity without debt forgiveness, I said to you this morning, it's like putting an anorexic on a diet. It doesn't work. Because what happens is the debt can overwhelm you so quickly. And in Britain, what you did was you devalued your currency dramatically. So sterling against the Irish pound, Jesus. Against the euro. That's a Freudian slip. Against the euro, I mean, sterling collapsed against us, right? Which was disastrous for us. We cut interest rates very, very quickly. And the currency does what it's done. We in the euro did the opposite. We allowed the currency appreciate. And as you can see, Irish unemployment is 12%. Spanish is something ridiculous, like 25%. So the jury is still out. I believe that what the Americans did was the right thing, which was to allow the central bank to buy up all this big cash for trash scheme. I think that's what the Europeans... I mean, the Germans obviously don't like doing all this printing money. So you might have noticed something, that they've actually outsourced bad behaviour to an Italian. Exactly. So, because the Italians doing what the Italians always do in a crisis is they print money. That's what Italians do. They've been doing it for years. And the Germans realise that if we outsource this bad behaviour, it's like a subcontracting, you know? If we subcontract bad behaviour to the Italians, we won't look so bad, which is exactly what's happening. So I think we're following a reasonably plausible model. But the point is, to keep coming back to it, is that, you know, it's like when Mrs. Thatcher was around, the traumatic effect of targeting certain classes and certain sectors, as she did, and then winning in the end, you know, in terms of, you know, 10 years later having numbers that suggested you were doing well, bears no relation to the human trauma that caused. And I'm not saying economics can be preserved in a sort of petri dish and formaldehyde. Things do change, but the role of government is to minimise, I think, the impact of people. Like Galbraith once said, John Kenneth Galbraith, who's a great economist, not loved by people on the right, but he's wonderful.
he talked about the, he said the role of the leader is to understand the anxieties of the people and do something about it. And I think the anxieties of the Irish people were heard in emigration and unemployment, and these things you've got to fix.
It's interesting that scarring effect that unemployment has, which you're really referring to. You can see in the chairman of the Federal Reserve in the US, Janet Yellen, she's a labour market economist, so she seems to get it that the most important things in economies to a large extent is about jobs. And if you don't have jobs, then you just cause lasting generational damage, which is what we see.